Well, the bottom line is that I told Buck straight out in Cliff's presence that the grand jury was hotter than a $2 pistol, and that they'd been, you know, trying to draw their own indictment against Harold Stringer, and complaining to the judge, and that I thought they were would be completely out of control unless this information was filed, as Buck and I had promised them it would be filed. And my best recollection then and now would be that I said, you know, if they indict anybody over this, it isn't going to be me, because I've done what I told them I'd do. Now, you know, the ball's in your court, or words to that effect. I can't remember any of that. So that was the, I guess, during the Stringer trial at lunch one day, probably Cliff Groh, I think he was of counsel to Stringer, may not have been, I don't know. But anyway, Wendell Kay somehow learned about this contretemps that Buck and I had in Cliff's presence that night. So that was the basis of the question. Mm-hmm. And Cliff's recollection was that I had threatened Buck. Last time the subject came up between me and Buck, he couldn't remember any of it, and or didn't want to. Mm-hmm. He's a very, very kindly guy. But I don't think I threatened him. I'm sure I didn't. I know I didn't. He hadn't done anything. Mm-hmm. You know, well, in the first place, assistant U.S. attorney doesn't draw an indictment against the U.S. attorney if he wants to go on. Living, you know, it's really ridiculous.
Was the whole thing an effort to get Stringer off?
I mean, yeah, it was just another. No. Sure, it was another defense that Mr. K was presenting for his client. Mm-hmm. Now, an experienced judge, mm-hmm, would have known that that question was completely irrelevant to the Stringer case. Yeah. And wouldn't even have allowed the question, mm-hmm, let alone made an order to show cause against me why I shouldn't be disbarred and imprisoned for contempt of court.
Why, you answered the question, didn't
you? Yeah. But there again, nobody, not even me, but it didn't take me long to find it, had read In Re Michael, and that great series of federal cases which hold that perjury is not contempt of court unless it somehow causes the whole proceeding to grind to a halt and frustrates the whole judicial process. But as in the case of one lady who, I remember one of the federal cases, she said she didn't know the defendant, and it turned out she was his cousin, and she got on the jury, mm-hmm, and then when they went into the jury room, she put her head down and said, "Wake me up when you're ready to acquit." And this this was held to be contempt of court. Mm-hmm. Not that she's falsely said she didn't know the defendant, but that her false answers to the questions had completely frustrated the judicial process. But I sure didn't do that to the Stringer case. So we went to trial in the United States against Talbot, mm-hmm, on the contempt thing, put on no evidence.
And Fitzgerald was the...
Fitzgerald was the prosecutor. Mm-hmm. He was instructed by the judge to prepare that order and serve it on me, so I don't know how willing a participant he was or how much, whether he knew better or not. Mm-hmm. We've never discussed it. I think he was also the prosecutor in the Stringer case. It seems to me he was. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Why was he the prosecutor when Buffalo had been the U.S. attorney at the time and you had signed the information? Was Fitzgerald in the office?
When the case finally came on for trial, the Stringer case, why, Buck was out of office and so was I.
I see. So
and, it was a new gang. Right.
So what happened in that case?
I had some lawyer friends in San Francisco mm-hmm. who applied for a writ of prohibition to the Ninth Circuit, and Judge Denman didn't issue the writ, but he...
How do you spell that?
D-E-N-M-A-H-N. But he wrote an opinion saying, in view of the strong showing made by petitioner, mm-hmm. we're sure that the learned judge, when he's had an opportunity to rule, will dismiss his case, which he did. But he wrote a long opinion, which he called me a liar in every way he could, and then dismissed the whole proceeding and sent the opinion off to West to publish it. Mm-hmm. If I'd have been smart, I might have gotten West not to publish it, but.
Were there other disciplinary cases at the same time during the 1950s when you were here?
Yeah, there was one against Bailey Bell. Mm-hmm. I was a witness in that one, too. Shouldn't have filed it.
Did you file that, or were you just...
I filed it. Mm-hmm. I accused Mr. Bell of threatening me. And whether he did or whether he didn't, I shouldn't have done it.
Why? Why'd you say that?
Yeah. Well, I think it came within his First Amendment rights, probably. I shouldn't have taken it seriously.
What?
Any more than Cliff Grohl should have taken seriously whatever he thought he heard transpire between me and Buck. Mm-hmm. I think, you got to... Lawyers should cut each other a little bit of slack in these matters.
Did the Bell case happen before?
The Stringer case or after? Don't remember. But there was another Bell case. The main Bell case mm-hmm. was alleged tampering with a witness. Sure. Mm-hmm. And the witness's name was Wally Scarborough. And Wally and Mr. Bell's client, I think, were jointly indicted for a robbery, something like that. Anyway, the gist of the complaint against Mr. Bell, for which he was indicted, was that he had caused a co-defendant to write a false statement exonerating Mr. Bell's client in a burglary or something like that. And And he was indicted under a federal statute. Oh, yeah, I remember now. The night we got into Anchorage for the first time, our first night in Alaska, the headline in the paper, I don't know if it was the News or the Times, but was about Mr. Bell's having been arrested and handcuffed And, you know, local attorney handcuffed. Was it? But I remember huge headlines. And I remember Marie and I kind of laughing about it, you know, what kind of a town have we come to when that's the way they treat their attorneys. And that was what it was. Bailey had been indicted for tampering with a witness under a federal statute. But he was smart enough to hire George Grigsby. And George was smart enough to go look in the book and see that the statute only applied in United States District Courts. And so he filed a motion, and the motion was to dismiss on the grounds that the territorial district court was not a United States district court within the meaning of the statute. And Judge Diamond, who was a splendid judge, and if he didn't know the law, he knew where to find it, agreed with Mr. Grigsby and dismissed it, and that was it.
What was the reputation of the community, or what were lawyers' reputation in the community? You said the grand jury that you brought the Stringer case in front of was incensed by the high charge. Was there a feeling in the community that lawyers were charging too much? Or?
Oh, yes. I think it's probably was not as bad then as it is now. But,
What else did people feel about lawyers?
Well, it depended very much on the, and I don't think one could generalize at all. There were many, many Anchorage people who had lawyers whom they knew and loved and would trust with their lives, you see. And then there were others who had had bad experiences. And, but nobody, you know, people don't like to tangled up with courts and lawyers, and I'm always looking at it from the litigation side, which is the only, you know, what I did.
Were there certain lawyers that people distrusted, or were there certain kinds of law that people thought, I suppose distrusted more than others, or certain areas of the law? For instance, criminal practitioners, criminal defense attorneys, did people... you know, if they didn't need one, was there a feeling that you couldn't trust them? Or?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so.
I'm just fishing.
So uh-huh.
Are there any kind of generalizations that you can make about how people felt about lawyers in Anchorage?
Oh, I think they felt just like people do everywhere. That's...
And how's that?
Well, they're sort of like dentists and undertakers. Sometimes you do need them, but you'd rather not on the whole, you know.
Yeah.
That's about it. But I... it was really such an individual matter.
There was no general feeling?
No.
What about the difference between discipline in New York, where you come from, and discipline here, or even the conduct of practice here versus the conduct of practice where you come from?
Well, in New York, I never heard of an attorney being disciplined. You know, it never. I had no experience with the whole subject.
Yeah.
The Admiralty Bar in New York, particularly in those days, had the highest code of respect and honor and dignity and ethics. It was amazing, just amazing.
Was there, when you got to Anchorage, the lawyers, there were so few lawyers that you must have known each other.
Yes, we met informally every Saturday afternoon, if you could make it, at, what was the name of the restaurant? I'm sure you know it.
The Oyster Loaf?
No, that was right. It'll come to me.
The Lido Cafe?
The Lido, sure. It was the Lido. every Saturday afternoon. And every time a new lawyer showed up, he was at one of those. He was immediately sent across the street, and he daren't come back with less than 2 quarts of whiskey, which we would set right on the table and stay all afternoon. Or sometimes if Frida was the waitress that looked after us all those years. And sometimes if Frida wanted to, you know, to close the room, why, we would adjourn to, I think it was City Mike's across the street. Toledo. Never. You couldn't get. Judge Diamond took a very, very strict view of a judge's relationship with the bar. Mm-hmm. The strictest I ever saw of any judge, anytime, anywhere.
Judge
Anthony Diamond.
Yeah.
Would have nothing to do socially with any lawyer in Anchorage or anywhere else.
Did you ever hear why?
It was just his view that he had to not only, you know, be impartial, but he had to appear to be impartial. Mm-hmm. And that was it.
What about Judge McCary?
Pretty much the same. Mac was, he was very proper in that regard.
Judge Folter?
No, Folter would go hunting and fishing with selected lawyers. And
how are these lawyers selected?
Well, if they liked to hunt and fish and could keep up with him. He was a great outdoorsman, a great sportsman. But I think that Buckaloo and Bess, particularly.
Any other?
Were hunting companions of his. Those are the only two that I...
What about Judge Pratt?
I didn't know Judge Pratt very well. I know his daughter was in town here. Mm-hmm. I think I appeared before him once or twice. He was a classmate of my friend Harold Waldo's, a guy back in Salt Lake, at the University of Colorado at Boulder. Mm-hmm. The thing that I remember about Judge Pratt was his green eye shade that he always wore. I think he may have worn a robe, too, which would have set him apart.
Did Folter wear a robe?
Folter, Diamond, none of those judges ever wore robes, and they thought the wearing of robes was improper.
Wow.
That it smacked too much of majesty and divinity and had no place in a democratic society like Alaska.
What about McCary?
2 or 3 robes, as fast. The robe was a great protection to Mac, well, it's sort of like a priest's vestments. You know, it reminds him that he's a priest when he has them on, and I'm sure that it worked that way with Judge McCary. But they've all worn robes ever since Judge McCary, he started it. And I don't know about Judge Pratt. He might have had a robe on the day I saw him.
Why did he wear a green visor?
The lighting was terrible in the courtroom, and it was to protect his eyes from the glare. But it looked like, you know, he could have been dealing Pan or something. It was funny.
The bar was organized in 1955. Did that change the practice at all?
Well, it did. In sure, it did. It brought the it brought the lawyers of the whole state together a lot more. Mm-hmm. We got to know, at least I got to know the Juneau and Ketchikan and Fairbanks bunch a lot better. And we started handling our own disciplinary matters, which was a big improvement. Mm-hmm.
Can you contrast the Juneau and Ketchikan and Fairbanks bars with Anchorage? Were they different?
Yes, each one had its own character. Ketchikan bar was, they were the greatest bunch of guys for fun that I've ever known in my life. And I don't know, Cloudy and Jertberg lived in a different part of town, so they had their own bar association, just the two of them. And they called it the South Tongass Bar Association, which was only loosely affiliated with the Ketchikan bar. And but we, you'd always get getting these telegrams and letters and stuff from the Ketchikan bunch. And every convention was a riot because they would show up no matter where it was. And it was a scream. It was really fun. And the Juneau bar, very staid, very dignified. Mm-hmm. And Fairbanks probably about halfway in between.
So they weren't as boisterous as the Ketchikan bar?
No, nobody could be.
Was it a reflection of their, did their practices reflect this at all?
I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I don't think so.
Who were the leaders in the bar who were known as being the most influential or whatever you think?
Norman Banfield ran Juneau.
When you say ran, what does that mean?
Well, I noticed as the years went by that there were never any in the grievance thing, and I was chairman of the grievance committee for this district for a couple of years and so on, got involved with the Supreme Court about who should handle grievance stuff, but noticed that there were never any grievances in Juneau, ever.
Why not?
Norman wouldn't allow it. Norman took care of it, see? And that was all. Now, there was the other firm, Monagle, mm-hmm. Mike Monagle's firm.
Robertson Monagle.
Mm-hmm. But there wasn't any problem came up that Norman and Mike couldn't handle. Mm-hmm. And so that was it.
What about Bert Faulkner?
Faulkner, had, when I got here, had already retired and mm-hmm. and was living in San Francisco. So I never actually met Bert Faulkner. They say he was a wonderful lawyer.
So by the 50s, he'd retired.
Yes. Yeah. Boutchever, of course, was a Cornell man and the first one in the territory. He preceded Krasilowski by quite a bit. He was already practicing, was a partner. It was Faulkner, Banfield, and Boutchever.
Did Krasilowski come up because of Boutchever?
It could be. It could be. Boutchever was an Ithaca mm-hmm. fella and born and raised in Ithaca.
Was he close to Fulton?
And yes, I'm sure. I'm sure.
Did politics figure into the bar?
In this way, there was, as I recall, for a number of years after the bar was first, organized, it was a question of plaintiffs, personal injury plaintiffs, lawyers against insurance, the insurance bar, mm-hmm. and they were sharply divided along those lines.
Can you tell me the people on either side?
Sure, it was always. Davis, Hughes, Plummer and Arnell did a lot of defense work, but I don't know whether they ever. I can't think of Ray or Ed getting involved in bar politics from that point of view.
What about at the Nome Bar Convention? The Nome Convention?
I missed that convention. I didn't go up there. But it was funny because I had a large insurance defense practice. Mm-hmm. But I always sided with the plaintiff's bar. Well, I enjoyed their company a lot more, and I always believed in the people who had been in insurance companies were in the business of collecting premiums and paying just claims, mm-hmm. and that was always my position. And I made enemies in the insurance defense bar as a result of it. Wendell Kay, Bailey Bell, later on John Savage, George Boney, Bob Parrish from Fairbanks.
Are his sons still in it?
Yeah, he's got two or three Skookum young guys up there. And Bob did quite a bit of work here. Then, of course, well, when you're talking about the Alaska bar, from the conservative mm-hmm. point of view, you'd always start with Norman Banfield. But Norman, I love Norman. We always got along mm-hmm. fine. But and then in the insurance defense, Chuck Clasby in Fairbanks did that work there. Mm-hmm. And in Ketchikan, I guess it was Cloudy's firm, Ziegler.
Did Ziegler practice?
Yes, and his father, Adolf Ziegler, mm-hmm. was a wonderful man. And Judge Gore, one of the stories they tell, I heard Adolf Ziegler tell this one. He said he and George Grigsby were defending a murder case in Juneau, and George Folta was prosecuting. Don't know who the judge was. But in his closing statement or argument, Folta, referring to Ziegler and Grigsby, said, "Now, folks, don't be misled by the shenanigans that you've heard and seen in this courtroom during this trial, because this defendant is guilty. But he's been represented here by the two most brilliant and unscrupulous lawyers north of Seattle." And George Grigsby stood right up at his counsel table and said, "Folks, I'm the brilliant one."
So Ziegler worked with Grigsby sometimes.
Sure, they certainly did in that case. Yeah.
I always thought that Grigsby had mostly a criminal defense practice.
Yes, but he had some civil cases too.
He did.
Yeah.
In the 19th, are there other heads of the bar besides Banfield's name? And Buchiger.
And Monigold, Eastaw. Those were Eastaw, yeah, Fred Eastaw. Mm-hmm. Those were the leaders in the Juneau. And in Ketchikan, it was Judge Gore and Adolf Ziegler. These were old men then, mm-hmm. but they were, you know, they were the senior guys. And in Fairbanks, it was Chuck Clasby. Warren Taylor, Sr. Mm-hmm. happened in Anchorage, George Grigsby, Wendell Kay, Buell Nesbitt. These are the guys who were leaders of the Anchorage Bar Association. Grigsby was a perpetual president, but he had no duties. Mm-hmm. And the vice president was the one who did all the work. And that was Wendell Kay for a number of years, and then Buell Nesbitt after Wendell.
What about Harold Butcher?
Yes, Harold was secretary and treasurer. Mm-hmm. And it was hilarious. Well, one of the little rituals we had at every meeting was to call for a treasurer's report. And Harold would say, "We've got enough." And that's all he would say. That's right. Yes, we paid dues, and there were assessments, too, because we had to throw parties and things. And the Christmas parties we had were great. Mm-hmm. We combined them with George Grigsby's birthday, which fell in December. And I never forget one of Grigsby's, Bill Renfrew made this long, long speech at the banquet, and very humorous and just wonderful about Grigsby and about his life and all kinds of good jokes, and just had us rolling in the aisle. And when he got all through with us, it was very laudatory, though. When he got all through, the old man, Grigsby, stood up and he looked at Bill and he said, "Sir, you do me but simple justice." Then he turned to this is the old idle hour out here, and then he turned to the group, and we were all there with our wives, and he said, "It's just great, these birthday celebrations." He said, "2 years ago, they gave me a TV set. Last year, I gave it back to him." He didn't know the present we had for him this particular year was Dagmar, the Swedish TV personality, mm-hmm. who had been playing at the Lido Club, which was, hadn't gotten paid, I guess, and she'd come to Ralph Moody and me, or she'd come to Ralph. She was his client, and she was staying in town while we collected her money for her. Mm-hmm. But it was the time of the Christmas party, so we arranged with Dagmar for her to run. Instead of jumping out, popping out of a big cake, she ran in and hugged George and kissed him, and he went along with it very well. Well, that was his present that year.
So the head of the Anchorage Bar, all the people who were leading it were plaintiff's attorneys. Is that right? I'm talking about...
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's right.
And the people who were heading the Juno Bars were insurance defense attorneys.
Yes, except that those two big firms in Juno did everything. They did everything. They sort of split up the whole business between them, and John Diamond was one of the few solo practitioners in Juneau. Mm-hmm. Roger Connor was another.
But they did finally both join
those firms?
Yeah.
Did they?
Yeah.
I'd forgotten
Roger
that.
Roger Connor was with Poppy Banfield.
Mm-hmm.
And I think so was Diamond. But briefly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think they made it hard for solo practitioners.
That's what I'd heard, although I never heard Roger or John complain. But,
and Judge Stewart had been a solo practitioner.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, good old Tom.
Why do you say good old Tom?
Well, I always think of him in connection with the holdup of the First National Bank.
I was thinking of the bar fight. time?
Sure, I do.
Okay, why don't you tell me about the court bar fight? How did it start? And before you do that, let me just go back to the Nome Convention.
Yeah, okay.
When the Judicial Council, the first people who were appointed to the Judicial Council, were decided upon by the Board of Governors. What was the whole story behind that?
I'll tell you, ma'am, I forget. I know that there was something about Harold Stringer maybe being appointed or not being appointed, and there was some kind of a rhubarb, but I do not remember.
Yeah.
I missed that convention. And
yeah. If it was a contest between insurance defense and plaintiffs, getting lawyers who would be partial to those sides. Or was it
I'm sure that would have been a factor. Mm-hmm. I would think, anyway.
Yeah.
At least if it wasn't then, it soon became a factor.
Mm-hmm. Who's won out?
Who won out?
Yeah, who, as far as?
Oh, I think the plaintiffs probably eventually, plaintiffs bar came to the top. George Boney, for example, was a very, very plaintiff-minded attorney and judge and chief justice.
Okay, to the court bar fight.
Well, by this time, the Westward Hotel had a banquet facility. Mm-hmm. So we have our bar lunches over there, and I think we'd gone to having a Monday noon. And at noon one Monday, forget who was, I think probably Wendell Kay was presiding. And he said, you fellas have all gotten this great big thick thing in the mail from the Supreme Court, which purports to be a proposed set of rules for the Bar Association or something. And has anybody here read it? The stuff that you got in the mail, 2 weeks ago. And nobody would raise their hand. The thing was too bulky. Nobody'd read it. So Wendell said, well, we better have a committee read the thing and see what's in it. So he says, I'll appoint Dave Talbot and myself, committee of two. And he said, Dave, you read it. So I went home and I found my copy and I read the thing. And I was horrified. It was a purported takeover by the Supreme Court of Alaska of our statutory bar association, and it abolished the statutory bar and created a new bar association as part of the Supreme Court, and it was right off the wall and right out of the blue, and I didn't like it.
Why did it come about?
I later found out that the thing that prompted it was the dilatoriness of the Ketchikan and Fairbanks bars in the handling of grievance matters, and nothing else.
It didn't have anything to do with Anchorage or with Juneau?
No. Of course, Juneau, as we've noted, never had any disciplinary problems, and Anchorage was absolutely up to date. And the reason I know it was up to date is because I was chairman of the grievance committee, and I just had more fun keeping it up to date, it was really great. By then I'd learned how to handle grievances, you see, and what you do is you call that attorney up and you go over and see him at 5 o'clock, and tell him that he's got a problem. And with any luck at all, by 5 o'clock the next night, there is no more problem. He straightened it out with his client or with his opponent or with the judge or whoever it was, and you You make a little note for the file and mark it closed and go on to something else.
Yeah.
And it was either 2 or 3 years that I had the grievance thing for the whole third district, and by then we were getting a few lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
But during my time in office, no attorney got in any kind of trouble whatsoever. There wasn't just, we were lucky, but
yeah.
Praise God, nothing serious came up, and the little things we could handle would dispatch. And
what about Neil McKay? Didn't they open that?
Yes, and Justice Nesbitt caused the McKay. That's getting a little...
ahead of the game?
Yeah.
Then let me ask a different one first.
Okay.
What was wrong with the Ketchikan and Fairbanks bars that had prompted this?
They had grievance matters that had been pending for years,
mm-hmm.
and they hadn't done anything with them.
Did people complain to the Supreme Court?
Sure, and Justice Nesbitt was getting letters,
mm-hmm.
you know, daily from irate citizens.
Were there any lawyers in particular who were involved?
Can't remember who they were.
Are there any records?
Oh.
That are open?
I suppose. But there were not any notorious cases. I mean, it wasn't anything...
it wasn't anything where someone just kept practicing even though there were lots of grievances being filed against them.
No, I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I don't think there were any, you know, bad actors that had to be gotten out of the bar at that time in either place.
Mm-hmm.
It was just... as you know, the whole country is sort of divided on the statutory versus court integrated bar. I didn't know it at that time. We hadn't given it any thought. We had a statutory bar on the California model.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, we had just had, that year at our convention, we had Joe Ball of Long Beach, who was a former president of the California Bar.
Mm-hmm.
When we got in the fight with the Supreme Court, we learned that there are these two, for the first time really, that there are these two concepts of state bars. The state of New York, when I left there, I don't know whether they have a state bar association now. They still don't. Well, and my ticket back there is probably still good because I haven't sent them any dues or anything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Are you a member of the New York Bar?
No.
Yeah. But the other states, you know, you were a stepchild of the Supreme Court of your state, or you know, were statutory.
Mm-hmm.
And I much preferred the idea of the California system. I thought that it gave lawyers a certain independence of the judiciary that they needed, and there are lots of lawyers who practice law all their lives without ever going near a court.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're corporation lawyers of various kinds, house
mm-hmm.
counsel, and so I didn't see the necessity of it, and.
But the court wanted to change the whole system of the organization of the bar. They wanted it to be a court bar.
Yeah, they actually, this proposed rules established a totally new...
Integrated bar.
Bar association. And when I went, I called Wendell, I remember calling Wendell up and saying, hey, we're in trouble. This is ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
And so then, I guess maybe at the next meeting, I probably briefed the Anchorage Bar on what was going on, and they got up in arms, and the Board of Governors all declined to have anything to do with the court's New Bar Association.
What about the other bars?
I remember Bob Boutchever was the president of the Alaska Bar at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And he and Clasby was the was on the board. Remember, Pete Kalamarides was the executive secretary. But the whole board of governors, they either sent a joint letter or individual letters to the Supreme Court saying, we are the board of governors by statute. We have read your proposed rules. We are going to have nothing to do with your rules or with your bar association. If you want to have a bar association, you're going to have to, the three of you are going to have to go out to lunch or something. That was the, so it, so this Justice Nesbitt completely lost his head. And this series of really remarkable orders started coming out of the Supreme Court of Alaska. Ex-party, self-starting, you know. No, not only no due process, but no process at all. Orders removing the Board of Governors en masse. An order removing Pete Kalamarides as executive secretary. An order appointing Ernest Raybock as a receiver, sort of, I forgot what they call him, administrator for the Alaska Bar Association.
Is he a lawyer?
Yes, but he was then, I guess, administrative director of the court system or something like that. Anyway, he had. No, that was probably Tom Stewart, but he was on Judge Nesbitt's staff.
Mm-hmm.
And sequestering our bank account, the Bar Association's bank account, desks, furniture, filing cabinets, the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.